today. We're going to go now through some specific texts, both biblical and non-biblical, to try to characterize this historical period and give you a picture of the very complex relationships between these little powers and the great power of Assyria, with, to a lesser extent, Egypt. Last time we painted the broad picture for you. During Iron 2A, Assyria is, without question, the dominant power of the ancient Near East. Assyria, based here. Egypt is not as powerful, but is playing the devil's advocate from the other side of the Fertile Crescent, always trying to stir up troubles for Assyria in the Syria-Palestine area, which was between the two of them. In Syria-Palestine, the empire of David and Solomon and the Phoenician counterpart are basically gone as units, and they have now been replaced by many, many small states, almost, as I will read it for you in some of the Assyrian texts, almost in some cases city-states. In Palestine and Jordan, it's not city-states, it is really states. We have, moving to this map, we have North Israel, we have Judah, we have Ammon, Moab, and Edom. But we will see that the Assyrian references to the rest of this area is not, these references are not to the Phoenicians, or to the Arameans, or to the Philistines. No, it's to cities, it's to Hamath, Damascus, Tyre, Gaza, each with its own king. That's why when the Assyrians come across, these great needs are created. Each time different cities go together to try to stand up to the Assyrians, always ineffectively. But up in this area, we're faced with powerful city-states. Down here, we have, this is the beginning of the really strong state period for all of these little small states. Israel, Judah, Ammon, Moab, and Israel, and Edom in the south. The biblical tradition now on this is quite one-sided, and we don't get a great deal of information about Ammon, Moab, and Edom from this tradition, but we're going to try to gain out of it, try to pull out of it as much as we can, at the same time presenting some of the internal problems and conflicts that characterized the two states of Israel and Judah. These two states were, as close cousins are still today, bitter enemies, and we're going to see that they were not allied in most circumstances. Sometimes they were, but under most cases, they were rivals. And they turned on each other by making alliances with whomever they could to turn the table on the other side. Northern Jordan, up around the Ajalon Mountain area, was still largely part of North Israel, but we will see fighting for that takes place with the Arameans of Damascus. All right, first we want to give you an idea of what things were like between these two small states, Israel and Judah, and the entry now, for the first time really, of the Arameans. Remember, under David and Solomon, this area was under their control. But in the latter days of Solomon, it said that Damascus became free, and it was a thorn to Solomon. He could no longer control it. By this time, Iron 2A, Damascus, Hamath, Homs, Aleppo, these are strong, powerful city-states. Damascus was the strongest of all, but the others were quite important and powerful as well. 1 Kings 15 is a part we want to concentrate on, where it says that we have a war early in Iron 2A, a war between the two new states, Israel, North Israel and South Judah. Verse 9. First Kings 15, then. Move up to 16. We'll save a little bit of time by moving up to verse 16. And there was a war between Asa and Baasha. Asa was the king of Judah, and Baasha was the king of Israel. There was war between Asa and Baasha all of their days. And here now is an example. Baasha, king of Israel, from the northern part of Israel, came down to fortify the new border that existed between these two states. Up till now, there had been no boundary between Israel and Judah. These were all tribes that were united, and so there was no political boundary between these two parts. Now, with Jerusalem and Judah separated from Israel and Shechem area, there has to be a boundary between these two, all right? Baasha tries from Israel to go down and construct a border that would divide him from Judah, because he doesn't want his people to go down into Judah for two reasons. One, to go to the temple in Jerusalem, and two, the other, for any kind of interaction with those people down in the south. All right, so Baasha goes up to build Ramah as a military post along his border. Ramah is a little bit north of Jerusalem. It's somewhere in the, not too far from Ramallah area of modern-day Palestine. He goes up to build Ramah so that he could permit no one to go in or to come out to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa, now this is the typical kind of thing that goes on. Asa, king of Judah, what does he do in response to this? Asa, king of Judah, took all the silver and the gold that was left in the treasury. Now how much is left? Can't have been a whole lot left, because not too long ago we had Shishak came up and took all everything that existed at that time down to Egypt. So there can't have been a whole lot. But anyway, it was enough. He took all the gold that was left in the treasures of the house of the Lord, that is the religious money, as well as the political money, the king's house, and he gave all of this treasury into his messengers, and he sent a message to where? Where do you suppose he sent a message to?
Damascus.
Yes. This is all, you know, it's like modern Middle Eastern garbled up politics all over again. You have allies, you wouldn't believe, coming back and forth with each other, changing all the time. Here we have Asa sent this to Ben-Hadad. Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hethion, the king of Syria, who dwelled in Damascus. And he said, let's make a league, Syria and Jerusalem, between you and me, as there had been in the past. Behold, I am now sending to you a present of silver and gold. Go, break the agreement that you already have with Israel. You know, there's a reference. We don't know about this agreement, but there's a reference here to the fact an agreement already exists between Damascus and Israel, a sort of a non-aggression pact. And Judah is now trying to basically buy the changing of that so that Damascus will turn on Israel. It's the typical thing. The pressure is here, so he wants to put pressure here so that Israel will pull back to defend this border, just like the Russians on the Chinese border, if the Syrians go into Laos, or the Syrians, the Chinese go into Laos, that kind of a thing. All right? Break your league with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from my border. And Ben-Hadad liked what he heard from King Asa. Baasha heard it. He had to stop building Ramah. Down here, Baasha, the king of Israel, had stopped building Ramah because he was being attacked up here. And let's see. Let me find where I am here. He stopped building Ramah and he went back to Tirzah. Tirzah was the capital at this time near Shechem. Then what did Asa, the king of Judah, do?
being a good opportunist, he went up to Ramah, which was just across the border, went up to Ramah, made a proclamation to all Jews so that nobody was exempt. Or he raised an instant corvée of labor down in Judah, and they went up to Ramah and they carried away all the stones and all the timber with which Baasha had been building in Ramah, and with them King Asa built his own fortifications on his side of the border at Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah, which is a little bit to the south of the site of Ramah. That's probably modern-day Tel Aviv or close to Tel Aviv. So that's one simple account now of what goes on between these two and relation with one neighboring power. All right. Now, this is a rather petty period. It's a petty period immediately following the fall of David and Solomon, but we quickly have the rise of the Omride power in North Israel. In North Israel. This rise to power is by coup, as it often was in Northern Israel. We said before that North Israel did not have a dynastic kingship. Southern Judah did. It followed the Davidic line. Moab, Ammon, and Edom all had kings. Often we have their fathers listed, so they probably were somewhat dynastic, although we can't be entirely sure because we don't have their full king list. I have passed out for you the list that we now have, but it's not totally interlocking to guarantee that these are, that they are always passing it from father to son. But we have no statement that the Ammonites, Moabites, or Edomites ever coup against their existing king. We do have the Assyrians meddling in kingship, but not the local individuals. So Moab, Ammon, and Edom were probably favoring the kingship being passed from father to son. That was something that was favored in Israel, but didn't usually occur except under Omri and Ahab. Now we want to read about their rise, 1 Kings 16, from verse 15 on. This is a typical military way of taking power. This is, let's see, we'll start off with verse 15. In the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, so Asa was still king down here. One of the fortunate things is the biblical record is constantly cross-referenced from Israel to Judah, back to Israel to Judah, Judah to Israel. So we know which king changed and who was king in the opposite country every time, even though the account may be talking about the other country. All right, Zimri reigned for 7 days in Tirzah. This is a typical thing. Zimri became one of the kings of Israel. Tirzah was located near Shechem, and Zimri had a kingship of a whole 7 days. Now his troops were camped against a city, I don't know where it is, but it's very interesting that it says what? Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines. We have the Philistines coming back here. The Philistines are here, and we see them again in the Assyrian sources now. The Philistines are independent. There's no statement that says they became independent, but they are independent. Many people say that the Philistines died out with Saul, with David. That is, he defeated them and that was it. It's clearly not the case. They were under David and Solomon for a very short period. And then after that, they had a resurgence of independence and they stayed that way, but as city-states again, not as a monolithic state, right, which belonged to the Philistines. And the troops who were encamped heard it said, Zimri has conspired, and he has killed the king. So Zimri has become the king by killing the king. Therefore, all Israel made Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel, that day in the camp. All right. So Omri, the commander of the army, is out with the army fighting the Philistines. In the capital, Tirzah, Zimri, a nobody, has taken the kingship from the previous king by coup. And he lasts for 7 days. So Omri went up from Gibbethon and all Israel with him, and they laid siege to Tirzah, which was at that time the capital. All right? And when Zimri, who was inside Tirzah, saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the king's house and burned the king's house over him with fire, and he died.
because of, it says that because of the sins that she committed, etc. However, basically political or military. All right, then the people of Israel were of two minds after this. Omri had defeated Zimri. Zimri burned his head down on himself, and part of the people followed Omri, and the other part followed a man named Tibni, who wanted to make Tibni king. This is a very interesting little statement. To make Tibni king, and half followed Omri. But the people who followed Omri overcame the people who followed Tibni. So Tibni died, and Omri became king. It's a very brief, very typical little thing. It's very like David's rise, the same sort of way. And so Saul died, David asked to be king. And then
we don't know how Tibni died.
It's just, and so he died. Or it's like your child coming up, Mom, the bottle broke. It's not really said who killed Tibni or what happened. It's just so Tibni died and Omri became king. All right, so now what does Omri do? Omri is really another kind of David figure. Omri sets a stamp on northern Israel, which lasts for almost 100 years, like the period of David and Solomon, but with far less grandiose expectations. All right, Omri had to have a capital city, and he didn't want the one that had just been burned down. He didn't want to take one that had any particular claims, the same as David did, so he took a new city, which was Samaria. And that is recounted to us also in this same chapter. So he went, after 6 years, he bought the hill of Samaria for 2 talents of silver. And after that, it became named Samaria, after Shemer, the former owner of the hill. Now, the Bible here gives us very, come on in, guy. The Bible here gives us very, very little evidence about Omri. It's a short thing here that talks about Omri. But we're going to see that Omri really was vital. The typical biblical evidence says, Omri did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did more evil than anybody who went before him. For he was similar to Jeroboam, the first king of Israel, and he made all Israel sin by having these idols, which probably came down mostly from Phoenicia. That's the only statement about Omri. He was a terrible ruler because he let in all these idols. Now, on the political, domestic scene, he was a very strong ruler. Omri founded Samaria. Archaeologically, we will see later that that is exactly correct. Samaria is not occupied before exactly the time of Omri. And Per Devaux has also excavated at Tirzah, and Tirzah was destroyed just about the time that Samaria was founded. So, and Devaux even made the point that many of the buildings, which were the last thing to be found in Tirzah, were unfinished. And so he thought that Tirzah was just abandoned as a capital, and they moved over to Samaria directly. I don't know, that's speculative, partly. It would agree with the evidence. All right, so Omri sets up Samaria. Now, what is Omri best known for, really, is for his son Ahab. Ahab was the son of Omri, and Ahab is probably considered to be worse or less worse only than his wife Jezebel. Jezebel is, in the biblical tradition, painted in the worst possible light, and Ahab and Jezebel are archetypal sort of evil figures in the biblical tradition. In fact, that's purely a biblical perspective, a religious perspective, and Ahab and Jezebel were the strongest of the kingly leaders of all of these states during their reign. We're going to see that Ahab and Omri are both very well attested in the Assyrian sources, and the name for Israel is given to them after their dynasty, after the house of Omri and Ahab. Jezebel was from Phoenicia, indicating again the very close relations between Phoenicia and North Israel. Ahab, we want to read 16:29. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel in Samaria for 22 years. Here we have the typical biblical comment. And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than any of those who preceded him. And it, you know, then it goes on to say that he made Baal and Asherah
the worship gods in Samaria, which is very true and very natural with the close relations between Phoenicia and North Israel. But from the Yahwistic biblical tradition, that was an extremely dangerous thing. And what it produced was, as we'll see later, it produced a sort of Khomeini-style revolution against this syncretism. Northern Israel copied, in many respects, the civilization of the Phoenicians. And that led to an internal conflict with her own traditions. And there was a very conservative element which objected to all of what Ahab and Jezebel stood for. And this was the prophetic tradition, Elijah, Elisha, which is what we always hear as the positive one in the Bible. It's hard to try to see these things as neutral as you can, because the Bible is so black and white. Ahab is evil and Elijah and Elisha are good. But in fact, it was a man trying to modernize his state and a man trying to develop the military and ally with the strongest powers of the day that kept the strongest state. Israel was the strongest state. Northern Israel was the strongest state at this time of Judah and all the other states here in Jordan and Palestine.
But he is condemned unilaterally, totally, 100%, in the biblical tradition. He did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. And in his days, people even sacrificed their children to rebuild city walls, like Jericho. That's cited as one of the things that's there. All right. I want to get in here now. I want to make sure I don't go out of sequence there. I've added a couple notes here that I want to get. All right. Most of the story about Ahab in the Bible is his conflict with the prophets, Elijah, Elisha, and stuff. It's not international relations. But there are international relations, again, with Syria in 1 Kings 22. And this is the death of Ahab when he moves
against the Syrians of northern Jordan. Damascus had moved down into northern Jordan and was challenging the control which Ahab had over northern parts of the Ajalon area, Irbid area, and southern parts of Syria. And the Syrian advance into that area had to be challenged by Ahab.
And Ahab goes out to Ramoth-Gilead, which is probably, in my opinion, Tel al-Hussein,
which is near Irbid. Other people put it elsewhere. But Tel al-Hussein is certainly the biggest site in that area, and it has the proper period represented at it.
All right, this account in 1 Kings 22 starts off like this. For 3 years, Syria and Israel continued without war, which is an unusual phenomenon. That is, there was only 3 years' time that Israel and Syria were not fighting.
Israel and Phoenicia were closely allied, but Israel and Syria were constantly fighting over this area here, especially over North Jordan.
Then, in the third year, Jehoshaphat, king of Israel, came to visit the king of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came to visit the king of Israel. And the king of Israel said to his servants, "Do you know that Ramoth-Gilead belongs to us, and we don't do anything to get it back? We aren't doing anything about the fact that the Syrians are occupying the Arameans. The Arameans of Damascus are occupying Ramoth-Gilead. Why aren't we doing anything about this?"
Despite the fact that now for 3 years there haven't been war. And he said to Jehoshaphat, "Will you go with me?" This is one of the few times we're going to see now that, not the few times, but one of the several times that Israel and Judah now allied. This is a complete switch. Judah had allied with Syria against Israel, but now it's going to be Israel and Judah against Damascus.
And so the king of Israel says to the king of Judah, "Will you go with me and fight for Ramoth-Gilead?" And Jehoshaphat said, I am as you are. My people are as your people, and my horses are as your horses. In other words, there's a brief emphasis here on the unity of these two groups, and so they begin. Then, in verse 29, the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, this is Ahab, I will disguise myself in the battle, but you wear your own normal kingly robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and went into the battle. So the king of Israel was looking like a normal soldier, while the king of Judah was in all his regalia. Now the king of Syria had commanded the 32 captains of his chariots. He had 32 captives of his chariots. Don't fight with either the small or with the great. Only go after the king of Israel. I only want the king of Israel on this day, this battle. And when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, they said, well, surely this is the king of Israel. So they turned to fight against him, and Jehoshaphat cried out. And when the captains of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. But then a certain man drew his bow, at a luck, at a chance, let it fly, and he struck the king of Israel between the scale armor and the breastplate. So that the king of Israel said to his chariot driver, and it was just a chance luck shot, turn about, carry me out, because I've been seriously wounded. And the battle grew very hot that day, and they propped the king up in his chariot facing the Syrians until the evening when he died. And the blood of the wound flowed into the bottom of the chariot. And about sunset, a cry went through the army, every man to his city, and every man to his country. That is, the army disbanded. So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood, and the prostitutes washed themselves in it, according to the word of the prophet. The prophet Elijah had said this would happen to Ahab. Now everything else which Ahab did, how he had an ivory house and all the cities which he built, aren't they written? So these are books we don't have. I wish we did. So Ahab went to sleep and his sons fell. All right, so here you have exactly the opposite. Judah and Israel fight against Syria. We have the Arameans coming in. No statement whatsoever about our three little states here in Jordan. Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Presumably, they were staying out of the action. So Ahab dies. This is now pretty much the end of the house of Omri. But King of Moab. It doesn't say yet where he is in Moab, but King of Moab here, Mesha, had to deliver tribute in the form of sheep materials every year to Israel. So Moab was clearly subservient to Israel at this time. That would have been under Ahab and under Omri, that Moab would have been subservient. But when Ahab died, the big kingpin. Ahab was the strongest of them all. When Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against Israel. So King Jehoram, who was the successor to Ahab in Samaria, marched out of Samaria, and he gathered all the armies of Israel. Mesha is trying to revolt after the death of Ahab. Syria has weakened Israel. For Moab to revolt. We assume that Moab up till this time was was still under Israel, even though we have no other statement.
All right.
Me, will you go with me to battle against Moab? And the king of Judah said, yes, I will go. We are one people. And then he said, how will we reach Moab? You are there, and I am here, and Moab is here. How are we going to attack Moab? There are two basic choices, around the north or around the south. And Joram said, by the way of Edom. Going around through the south. All right? So the king of it, now here we have a very another ally, Edom. Now what does this suggest? This suggests that Edom basically was a yes man to Judah. Edom was basically had to do whatever Judah said at this time. We're going to see that that was the case in other texts, because Edom then says, it says in Judah, Edom had to go along, coerced by Judah. So they picked up the king of Edom. And when they had made a circuitous march of 7 days, there was no water for the army, for the beasts, anything. And they said, alas, the Lord has called these three kings to give them into the hand of Moab. And Jehoshaphat said, oh, we'll skip this part. This is strictly about Elijah. He plays. And, all right, we want to get to the gory details. All right. When Elijah prophesied that the Moabites will be given into your hand, and you will conquer every fortified city, every choice city, and you shall destroy all the trees, etc. The next morning, about the time of offering the sacrifice, behold, they were very thirsty. Water came from the direction of Edom till the country was filled with water. Now, this we know from other accounts took place right down by Sodom. This is somewhere close to Sodom. That is, they were on the border of Edom, which is the Wadi Hessa. Somehow rain landed up here, and it didn't rain where they were, and the water came down through the wadis, which is a fairly common. Not a fairly common, but it's a phenomenon. We've been down in here when there's no rain down here, but it rains off to the east, and then the water comes down the wadis and pours out. All right? Now, when the Moabites heard that the kings had come up to fight against them, all who were able to put on armor, from the youngest to the oldest, were called out, and they were drawn up at the frontier. This is the southern frontier now of Moab. The Edomites are from the Hessa to the south, and the Moabites are from the Hessa north. So they're at the frontier here preparing for battle. And when they rose early in the morning, the Moabites, the sun shone upon the water, which was coming down the wadis. And the Moabites saw the water opposite them as red as blood. And they said, wow, that's not water, that's blood. These three kings who are allied against us have surely fought together with themselves, and they've all killed each other. So Moab, let's go out and grab all the spoil. If they've killed each other, all this stuff should be sitting there. But when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose and attacked the Moabites till they fled before them, and they went forward, slaughtering the Moabites as they went. And they overthrew the cities, this is really interesting now. How do you plunder a city here? I mean, how do you plunder a countryside here in the plateau land of central Jordan? They overthrew the cities, and on every good piece of land, what would you do to ruin land around here?
Stones on it.
That's right. On every good piece of land, every man threw a stone until it was covered. And so what would you do for water?
So that's why it's like that now.
What would you do for sources of water? You plug them up. They stopped up every spring of water. And what about the trees? They cut down every good tree till the only stones that were left at Kir Hareseth.
Kir Hareset is, by everybody's common agreement, Kerak. Kir Ho, we're going to see later, Kerak. All right, so they are marching north to aim at the heart of Moab, namely, not too far north. Kerak, right here. Kerak on the Wadi Kerak. All right?
And they surrounded the city, and the slingers, they were fighting by slingstones, the slingers attacked the city, and it was about to be defeated. And when the king of Moab saw that the battle was going against him, he took with him 700 swordsmen to break through opposite the king of Edom, but he could not. He couldn't break through. So what did he do then in desperation? Then he took his oldest son, who was to be his king following him, and he offered him up as a burnt sacrifice upon the wall of the city. And there came a great horror upon Israel, and they withdrew from him and returned to their own land. All right, so this here, I'm always pointing to north, is the biblical tradition now about how Kerak was not taken totally by this tripartite attack. Israel, Judah, and Edom ganged up against Mesha, king of Moab, in Kerak.
All right, we want to move on again here now. We're going to read the Mesha part of this also, but we'll come to that below. All right, we have now several references to Edom, which I want to pick out because they show us the relationship of Edom to these other powers. First, in 1 Kings 22:47, going back a little bit, this is at the time of Ahab. It says here, Ahab and Jehoshaphat.
Ahab was king in the north. He was the one who was killed at Ramoth Gilead. And Jehoshaphat was king of Jerusalem. All right, at that time, what was the state in Edom? The state of Edom was as follows. There was no king in Edom. There was a deputy who was made king. And this was a designant of Judah. Judah designated this deputy. Should have been under the control of Edom. But because Jehoshaphat had a deputizing control over Edom, he was able to use this port area for trade to the south at that time. So during the time of Ahab, Edom is still directly under Judah. And when he saw the attack against Mesha, that would agree with this also, namely Edom went along with Judah, largely out of no choice. That is, Judah dominated Edom at this time.
All right, now the next reference to Edom is 2 Kings 8, 20. This is after the death of Ahab.
What has happened with the death of Ahab? We have Mesha revolting over here. And now we're going to see we have Edom revolting down here. In other words, Omri and Ahab kept things together until the death of Ahab, and then Mesha revolted from them. After the death of Omri and Ahab, Judah was also weak. It had been defeated also by the Syrians, and therefore Edom revolts and becomes free.
2 Kings 8:20. In his days, Edom revolted from the rule of Judah and set up a king of their own. That's just one sentence. That's all we have.
It's after the death of Ahab, Jehoshaphat also was weakened, and so Moab and Edom both declare independence. Mesha succeeds
the Bible, one thing, it said that the Israelites, Moabites, Israelites, Judah, and Edom attacked Moab, that they plundered the countryside, but it does not say, very importantly, that they defeated Mesha and forced him back into a subservient position. No, they withdrew from the horror of the sacrifice of his son, whether that's a biblical embellishment or not, we don't know. We'll see, Mesha doesn't mention this. But for whatever reason, Israel does not succeed in reestablishing a subservient position, role for Mesha. Edom is now independent, but Edom is going to go in and out. It's going to be up and down, independent, subservient. But right now, Edom gets free. All right? Now we have in North Israel, I just want to give you a taste of the religious politics in North Israel, where Omri and Ahab had been bringing in all of this Phoenician religion up here, which provokes this great religious turnover in the government. This is called the Revolt of Jehu. Jehu, we're going to see, he is also mentioned in the Assyrian sources. But Jehu overthrows the dynasty of Omri and Ahab and replaces it with a new one, which is much more radical, anti-Baal primarily, and so it is given very high marks in the biblical tradition. All right, this is found in 2 Kings 9. I'm going to just read a little bit about this. We can't do all of it. 2 Kings 9, verse 17. All right. Jehu, let's start with verse 14. Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, conspired against Joram. Joram was the son of Ahab. Joram, with all Israel, was on guard at Ramoth-Gilead against Hazael of Syria. All right? So Joram, the son of Ahab, was fighting again over in Ramoth-Gilead. They hadn't gotten back, so they were still fighting against the Arameans over here to try to get it. And King Joram had returned to be healed in Jezreel because he had been wounded. So Joram had been over here, and he returned to Jezreel. Where is Jezreel? Jezreel is pretty much close to modern-day Jenin in Palestine. Jenin is on the Megiddo coastline right here, the Megiddo-Tanakh-Ezra-Elim plain area. Jenin may even be Jezreel. It's a possibility.
Right.
So Joram was at Jezreel, and Jehu said, he was anointed. I have to go back here a little bit. Jehu was with the troops, and the prophet comes to him and anoints him and says, you should be the king over Israel. But he wants to keep it a secret. So he says, if I'm going to be the king, don't let anybody escape to tell anybody in Jezreel that you have anointed me the king. Then Jehu mounted his chariot, and he went to Jezreel, for Joram lay there. And Ahaziah, the king of Judah, was also there because he had come to visit. So we have two kings at Jezreel, and Jehu, the charioteer, the army, the military man again, the coup type, comes in and does the following. Now the watchman was standing in the tower of Jezreel looking out, and he saw off in the distance the company of Jehu as they were coming along, and he said, I see a company. And Joram said, this is the king, Joram said, take a horseman and send him out to meet them and say, are you coming for peace? So a man on horseback went to meet him and said, thus says the king, are you coming for peace? And Jehu said, what do you know about peace? Just join me. So the watchman reported, saying, the messenger reached them, but he's not coming back from them. He's with them. Then he sent a second horseman, who came to them and said, is it peace? And Jehu says, what do you know about peace? Come and join me. And again the watchman at Jezreel reported, he got to them, but he's not returning. And now, behold, this is a famous quote, the driving is like the driving of Jehu, the son of Nimshi, for he drives furiously. I get a kick out of this because the modern Arabic word Nimshi means
let's beat the hell out of here. Nimshi means let's run. And if somebody drives a car ferociously or horribly or very aggressively, that usually is described as a Jehu. He's a real Jehu. So Joram said, Joram now, the king of Israel, said, get my chariot ready, we have to escape. So Joram, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, set out, each in his chariot, and they went to meet Jehu, and they met him, this is important, on the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. This is the biblical religious part, because Naboth had been oppressed by Omri, and so they have to be killed on the property of this oppression. And Joram saw Jehu, and he said, Jehu, are you coming for peace? And he said, this is Jehu's answer. What peace can there be so long as there are harlotries and sorceries of your mother Jezebel are so many in the country? Then Joram pulled back his horses and he fled, saying to Ahaziah, oh, Ahaziah, treachery, we're both going to be killed. So Jehu drew his bow with his full strength and he shot Joram between the shoulders so that the arrow pierced his heart and he sank down in his chariot. And Jehu said to his aide, take him up and cast him on that plot of ground where he had oppressed this poor Naboth. And as then when Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, he fled. And Jehu fled after Ahaziah and said, shoot him also. And they shot him in the chariot at a certain ascent. And they fled to Megiddo, and he died there. And his servants carried him in the chariot to Jerusalem. And when Jehu came to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it. Jezebel was now back in Samaria. Jezebel. And what did she do? She painted her eyes. And she adorned her head. And she looked out the window. And as Jehu entered the gate, she said, is it peace, you Zimri? Who is Zimri? Zimri is the one who cooed a prior king. You Zimri, murderer of your master. And he lifted up his face to the window and he said, who is on my side? And there were two or three eunuchs who were standing there. And he said, throw her down from the window. And so they threw her down and her blood spattered on the wall and on the horses and they trampled on her and they went in and they ate and drank and they cursed the woman. Dogs came along and licked it all up, because this is what prophets had predicted would happen to Jezebel. But after this now, Jehu goes on a rampage and he wipes out all traces of Ahab's dynasty and of this kind of religion. Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. So Jehu wrote letters and sent them to Samaria, to the elders. He said, now, let me make this brief. He sent a letter inviting all the people and all the sons of Ahab and all the followers of Baal to a big celebration in Samaria. And when he lured them all into Samaria, he slew all that remained of the house of Ahab, all his great men and his familiar friends and his priests, until he left none of them remaining. Then he went to Samaria and I have to get to the part here. Well, he did it. He destroyed the worshippers of Baal. He sanctified a solemn assembly. Then he went in to burn, offer sacrifices and offerings. And Jehu stationed 80 men outside. And he said, anybody who lets anybody out will give up his own life. So as soon as they had made an end of offering the burnt offering, Jehu said to the guards and to the officers, go in and kill all these worshippers of Baal. Don't let one man escape. So they went in and they pulled down the Baal, burned it, they demolished the pillar of Baal and destroyed, they wiped out Baal from all of Israel. Jehu did not turn aside from any of the people who had sacrificed to Baal. So this is the revolt of Jehu. Now internal, wrenching northern Israel, and it weakens Israel. All right, let's take a quick break, a couple minutes, and then we'll come back to the arrival of the Assyrians, of the Israelites. And when it falls, that's going to be the end of their state. It was a very brief period, just really 200 years that they were there, from 918 to 721. After them, we're going to see something quite different happens in that region. The Assyrians now have not yet been mentioned in the biblical sources up till now. This is we are now getting the first reference to this group, coming from northern Iraq. They are the great power of the time, but strangely, the biblical evidence says nothing about Ahab or Omri or Jehu having contact with the Assyrians. Ahab, we're going to see, directly fights against the Assyrians and controls.
contributes troops, but the Bible says nothing about that fact. We know this from the Assyrian sources, which are just absolutely reliable. But the Bible doesn't tell us that there, that these contacts took place. Where we first have contact with the Assyrians is in 2 Kings 15, and it starts in a rather typical Byzantine way. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel,
Pekah is now king of Israel. Wait a second. I want to see if this is my first reference or my second. Yeah. Just 1 second here. I'm
gonna...
Yeah, hold that just a second. I don't know. In the 39th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Menahem, the son of Gadai, began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 10 years in Samaria. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Pul, this is verse 19, Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land. And Menahem, now Pul, P-U-L, is the person we're going to see below, is Tiglath-Pileser. Tiglath-Pileser is probably the greatest, most feared of all the Assyrian conquerors. Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver that he might help him to confirm his hold on the royal power. In other words, Menahem felt himself weak, and by giving this money to the Assyrians, he would enjoy their vassalship. And Menahem exacted the money from Israel by taxing from the wealthy men 50 shekels of silver from every man, so that he could give it to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned away and did not stay in the land. So Tiglath-Pileser had come down, Menahem paid tribute, and the king of Assyria went back. If he had not paid, we would have had one of the accounts of destruction and deportation that we'll be reading from the Assyrian side. So this is contact with North Israel now. Tribute is given, and this is the first time that we have mention of that tribute given. Then in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and he captured the following cities. Several of these are Kadesh, Hazor, much of the land of Naphtali, that's all the northern part up in the Galilee area of northern Israel. All the land of Naphtali, and he carried away the people captive to Assyria. Then, this is the very last years now of Israel's strength as we go down from 734 down to 721. These are a very short number of years before Samaria finally is destroyed. So under Pekah, these cities are taken. Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, and he struck him down, and he became king instead. This is all complicated. I'm trying to determine what to read. It's extremely complicated. A whole series of little kings follow one another. Let's move to verse 16, in chapter 16. In those days the Lord began to send Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So Judah was being attacked by Syria, and I'm just reading this quickly to give you the details, by Syria and Israel. Judah was being attacked. Then Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah in Israel, came to wage war on Jerusalem. Right, this is now where we really get the Assyrians coming in. They came to wage war on Jerusalem, and they besieged Ahaz, but they could not conquer him. So northern Israel and Syria
now gang up on Judah. At that time, the king of Edom had recovered Elath for Edom. So Edom was free. Judah was being penned in from all directions. Israel, Syria against Judah. The men of Judah had been driven out of Elath, and the Edomites came to Elath where they still live. Now, what does Ahaz do in this trap position? Let me reconstruct it again, all right? Israel had given tribute to the Assyrians, and therefore the Assyrians had gone away. But they came back and took some land of Israel anyway. Now, Israel and the Arameans gang up on Judah. And Judah is already weakened by having lost all of Edom. So Judah is just this little chunk of land right here being attacked by Israel and the Arameans. And Judah had lost her only usual ally, which was, namely, her vassal Edom. So what happened? Ahaz in Jerusalem had his back against the wall, but he was not yet defeated. So Ahaz then sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he said, I am your servant and your son. Therefore come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and the hand of the king of Israel, who are attacking me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold, whatever was left, in the house of the Lord and in the king's house, and they sent this present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria listened, and he marched against Damascus, and he took it, and he carried the people captive, and he killed Rezin, king of Damascus. And when King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, he saw the altar in Damascus, and he made one just like it. And King Ahaz cut off all the oxen. He covered everything because he had to give away all the good things to the king of Assyria. So Ahaz of Judah calls on the Assyrians to bail him out, because he is supposed to be a loyal subject to the Assyrians, and he's being attacked by two other people who are under Assyrian vassalage. So Judah is saved now by the invasion of Tiglath-Pileser. Now the fall of Samaria takes place not much longer thereafter. And this is 2 Kings 17. It's a fairly long account, but I'll try to find the most important parts. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, began to reign in Samaria over Israel, and he reigned for 9 years. Then against him came Shalmaneser. This is Shalmaneser the fifth of Assyria. We're going to see some problems here, but Shalmaneser seems to initiate this attack. Shalmaneser comes from northern Iraq and attacks Samaria. And Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria found treachery in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers also to Egypt. Hoshea was playing a double game. He had sent messengers also to Egypt, and he stopped paying his tribute to the king of Assyria, as he did every year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and put him in a prison. And he came and invaded all the land and came to Samaria, and for 3 years Shalmaneser besieged Samaria. And in the 9th year of Hoshea, he captured Samaria, and he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in a number of cities in Persia, over in Iran. So Shalmaneser came up because Hoshea refused to pay the tribute. Shalmaneser invaded, destroyed Samaria, and took all of the Israelites back. Then he brought them to Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and he brought people from Babylon, Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and placed them in the city of Samaria instead of the people of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria, and they dwelt in its cities. So Shalmaneser, according to this account, took the Israelites into Iran, and then he brought down eastern elements and settled them in Samaria. This is the starting now of the Samaritans. It's a mixed group. Some Israelites were left behind here, and they become mixed with these Assyrians and other mixed peoples, and this is where the Samaritans of modern-day origin still today start. All right, that's the fall of Samaria. Now, from the biblical side. We want to turn now to the Assyrian sources. All right? We have a number of very important Assyrian sources showing us things that are happening in this period. First, we'll start off with Shalmaneser III and the Battle of Karkar, which gives us a reference to a number of different peoples. This is A-N-E-T, page 278. A-N-E-T, page 278. It's incredible that this account is